about the Crystal Palace fire. He wasn't there. I can only reply by commenting that neither were the historians who tell us that Christopher Columbus discovered the New World. They weren't there. We just accept that their research was thorough, that they got their sums right. Seriously, though, I don't profess to know all the answers about the Crystal Palace, and trust that if any of you can help me, then you will step forward later. Having said that, my research is thorough, but hampered to some extent because several vital witnesses are no longer with us, having passed on. A word about Alexander Palace. When I heard about that fire, my comment was this. I wondered often just how long it would take. I don't think it will ever be rebuilt. One factor more than any other gave rise to speculation about the Crystal Palace fire. This was the delay over calling the fire brigade. A lawyer had been given much earlier times for the outbreak by several witnesses. 7:25 seems to be the most quoted, and is probably about right. At 7:59 p.m., Fenge Fire Brigade were called and responded at once, arriving at the palace at about 3 minutes past 8 o'clock. The delay between time of outbreak and calling the fire brigade was therefore about 34 minutes. Now, it has been suggested that the local fire brigades may have dilly-dallied over requesting assistance from London. This suggestion is without foundation. A request for a district call to the palace was received at Lambeth just after 8 o'clock. Indeed, the chief officer of the London Fire Brigade at the time, the late Major C.C.B. Morris, relates in his book called Fire how he had just finished dinner at about 8 o'clock when the phone rang in his flat at the new Lambeth headquarters to inform him of the district call for the palace. Major Morris writes as follows. From the balcony at the back of my flat on the fourth floor of our new headquarters, I could see the palace quite clearly in daytime. On stepping outside hurriedly to try to see if there was any sign of fire, I saw a dull red glow lighting up the whole of the centre transept. Definitely a late call. The fire must have been going for at least half an hour. We shall probably lose the whole building. This, as can be seen, was a pretty accurate appraisal by Major Morris. About a minute later, and just as Major Morris was leaving headquarters in his staff car, he was informed that a brigade call had just come in. The delay between the arrival of the Penge Fire Brigade and the London Fire Brigade being called amounted to nothing. In fact, both events were simultaneous. Why, then, did the palace delay so long? Two possible explanations are valid. A, that the palace staff became so preoccupied with trying to contain the fire that they simply forgot to call the fire brigade. A classic example of this is the recent Somerland disaster in the Isle of Man, of which the Commission of Inquiry had this to say, and I quote, "The great danger inherent in a firefighting party is that all concerned may so preoccupy themselves with fighting the fire, which is or becomes beyond their capacity to control, that no one remembers to call the fire brigade in time." There was a delay of 20 minutes at Somerland, and over 50 people died. The second explanation B for the 34-minute delay at the Crystal Palace, and what is to me the more valid of the two, is to be found in Section 30 of the Metropolitan Fire Brigades Act of 1865 and still in force in 1936. Section 30 of the Act reads as follows. It shall be lawful for the Board of Works, when occasion requires, to permit any part of the fire brigade establishment, with their various equipment, to proceed beyond the limits of the metropolis. In such cases, the owner and occupier of the property shall be jointly and severally liable to defray all the expenses that may be incurred by the fire brigade attending the fire. You are probably already aware that in 1936 the Crystal Palace lay just beyond the limits of the metropolis. You may also know of Sir Henry Buckland's anxiety about money and his reluctance to spend it. He knew that fire in the palace could cost him dear if the London Fire Brigade got in on the act, and in order to prevent that happening, he gave the palace fireman a strict standing order that that they must under no circumstances call the outside fire brigades without first obtaining his permission, or in his absence, the permission of Mr. Legg, who was his confidential private secretary. In other words, Sir Henry Buckland or Mr. Legg took it wholly upon themselves to decide when a fire was beyond their capacity to control and extinguish it. Of course, neither of them were qualified to make a decision of that nature, but it is excusable when it is realised that on the 29th of May 1937, Sir Henry received a bill from the London Fire Brigade for £2,569.13. This being the charge for their attendance on the 7th, 1936. In terms of 1936 values, £2,569.13 is an enormous sum of money, and one to be avoided like the plague if one was forced to count pennies like Sir Henry Buckland. I often wonder where the London Fire Brigade got the odd 13 and 7 pence from. On the morning after the fire, Sir Henry Buckland made a statement to the press and the Fire, which is the highly respected journal of the British Fire Service, a journal respected throughout the world for the accuracy of its reporting. This is what Sir Henry said, and I quote, "A streak of flame ran along the top of the room, and the place was ablaze in a moment. We thought then that gas was the cause. Now we know." He enlarged on this by claiming that there was a large gas container or tank near to where the fire started, containing many thousands of cubic feet of gas under pressure. Now, in 1971, when I started researching my book, Mr. W. E. Medhurst was principal distributing engineer for the Southeastern Gas Board. In 1936, he was a young engineer with the old South Suburban Gas Company, and he worked out at Sydenham Gas Works. Distribution being his specialty, and the Crystal Palace one of his biggest consumers. For this reason, he had to familiarise himself with the Palace gas supply. Mr. Medhurst told me in a letter that the supply to the Palace was a normal low-pressure main, working at less than 1 pound per square inch. The main was situated in the basement, entirely below ground floor level. Small bore pipes brought gas upwards to where it was required to be used in the building. Some gas lights out on the terrace required a slightly higher pressure of 2 pound per square inch, which was achieved by means of a small compressor located outside the Palace in a brick building on the Parade. The compressor was not in use on the night of the fire, because the terrace lights were not lit. I questioned Mr. Medhurst carefully about Sir Henry Buckland's large gas container or tank. This was Mr. Medhurst's answer, and I quote, "I am completely at a loss to understand what Sir Henry Buckland was talking about when he spoke of a large tank containing many thousands of cubic feet of gas under pressure. We most certainly never had any storage tank of any kind at the Crystal Palace. Even the gas meter was in a completely separate building." Mr. H. F. Marsh, maintenance plumber for many years at the Crystal Palace, can remember no gas container such as Sir Henry described anywhere within the complex. Like Mr. Medhurst, Mr. Marsh insists that the gas meter was in a completely separate building. Leaving the argument about gas to one side for a moment, let us look at the sequence of events on the night in question. Mr. S. Neal looked after the boilers, which heated the greenhouses in the Palace Gardens. He told me in a letter that he worked late that day until 7 o'clock. In which time he had left his greenhouses and arrived at the time clock near the main entrance in the central transept. He had just punched his time card dead on 7 o'clock when a passerby came in to tell a palace fireman that there was a red glow inside the glass. A fireman and Mr. Neal went to the spot indicated by the passerby, where they found a small fire burning at the back of the handle organ, close to the underside of the orchestra staging. According to Mr. Neal, this fire was extinguished without difficulty. Now, I must point out that I have not to date found anyone to confirm Mr. Neal's account. If there is anyone here able to throw light on this, I ask them to come forward later. Late Mr. Sidney Clark, known as Horace to his close friends, was dead before I commenced my research, but his widow was able to tell me of her husband's experiences on the night of the fire. Her account is almost identical with one to be found in the record room at County Hall, and is probably the most authentic we can hope for after a lapse of so many years. Mr. Clark was a night shift palace fireman. His whole life was spent working at the palace, except for war service in France, 1914-18. He was conscientious and took his duties seriously. He was well liked. He was on his first security patrol of the night and arrived in the Egyptian court at about 7:20. He could smell burning, but could find nothing amiss in the court itself, so he widened his search, going into a passageway which ran between the Egyptian court and the administrative offices which overlooked Crystal Palace Parade. In this passageway was a lady's cloakroom, and inside it Mr. Clark found a fire burning, which in his opinion, although in its early stages, and certainly not serious, would require a hose to extinguish it. To get a hose to work, Mr. Clark needed help, so he shouted for Mr. Frank Tullett, or Nobby as he was better known. Mr. Tullett was not a fireman. He was a general handyman, who had offered to see the night through with Mr. Clark because his regular mate had reported sick. This information was given me by Frank Tullett's daughter, who now lives near me in Hertfordshire. The first aid hose reels were not like the present-day type, which can be operated by one person, the water coming on automatically as the hoses ran out. In 1936, the hose was canvas and flaked. That is, it was hung on pegs and looped rather than rolled. A separate hand-wheel control valve had to be opened to bring on the water. Mr. Clark held the branch pipe and nozzle, while Mr. Tullett operated the hand-wheel, which he spun to the fully open position too quickly. The sudden rush of water caused the hose to kick backwards violently, throwing Mr. Clark off his feet and breaking his dentures and his glasses. This kicking effect with charged hose is very familiar to firemen, who are trained to deal with it safely. Leaving Mr. Clark to recover as best he could, Mr. Tullett ran to get help, going first to Mr. Legg's house. Mr. Legg responded at once, and while heading for the palace sent Mr. Tullett to Rockhills to alert Sir Henry Buckland, who happened to be coming out at about this time, along with his daughter. In an interview, Crystal Buckland told me that she could remember Nobby Tullett running up the road to meet them as they turned out of Rockhills. She wondered why he was running about outside, and not knowing about Mr. Legg's instruction, considered that he should have been inside fighting the fire. Mr. Legg reached the fire first, and with Mr. Clark's help got the hose back to work. Within a minute or two, Sir Henry, his daughter, and Nobby Tullett had arrived. At this point, the fire was still confined to the lady's cloakroom, and relatively small. Sir Henry sent his daughter to the garden hall to inform the rehearsing orchestra of the fire, and to reassure them that the fire was under control, and that it was safer to continue rehearsing. Crystal Buckland, or Mrs. English, she now is, confirmed this when I talked to her. While Crystal was away to the garden hall, the fire situation worsened with catastrophic suddenness. As already noted, Sir Henry Buckland described it as a streak of flame running along the room. But Mr. Legg was much more specific. In a statement made to staff reporter Alan Renz of the Daily Mail, Mr. Legg had this to say. Shortly after my arrival, I was told that fire had now broken out in the Egyptian hall. On looking in there, I found that part of the hall was ablaze, and a stream of flame was racing across the floor like a will-o'-the-wisp. We turned three hoses on it, but in what seemed no time, the trail of flame had blazed into the center transept. Within 15 minutes, the whole interior was a mass of flames. Now, Collins' New English Dictionary defines a will-o'-the-wisp as, sometimes referred to as jack-o'-lantern, a flickering, pale bluish flame darting rapidly from location to location and seen over marshes. This was Mr. Legg's stream of flame racing across the floor. If it resembled a will-o'-the-wisp, then it was blue in colour. If it was blue in colour, then it is almost certain that it was some kind of inflammable spirit. But which? To answer this, I put the problem to Her Majesty's Fire Research Station at Boreham Wood. Now, for those of you not in the know, this fire research establishment is recognised as being the world's best, and is staffed by engineers and scientists eminent in their field. Mr. P.N.T. Smart, the director of the station, wrote to me as follows. The eyewitness account of a bluish flames, or will-o'-the-wisp, racing along the floor is very interesting. The theory about gas being the cause can probably be discounted, because town gas is much lighter than air, and it is therefore unlikely that a thin layer of gas would stay at floor level. A serious gas leak would more likely have resulted in an explosion if exposed to a source of ignition. The transient coloured flames on the floor surface would seem to indicate the presence of an inflammable liquid having a flash point below room temperature. Whiskey is suggested by you as a possible accidental spillage as too high a flash point, and petrol does not fit the colour description, but methylated spirit, acetone and cellulose nitrate are the ones to go for, and are all possibilities worth considering. Sir Henry Buckland's tale about gas now looks decidedly threadbare. A gas leak in the presence of an igniter would likely result in an explosion. Paul L. Kirk is a leading authority on the subject of fire investigation. In his book he tells us that for town gas to ignite, a ratio of at least 1 in 10 must be achieved. 1 volume of gas to 10 volumes of air will produce a rolling fire, which is termed a diffuse explosion. This will push out walls, singe human hair and set clothing alight. There will be no hard detonation, rather a whoosh, and the whole place will be on fire. If Sir Henry Buckman's streak of flame was gas, then everyone in the vicinity would have had their clothing ignited, and they would have suffered burns. We know that neither occurred at Crystal Palace. I think that we can now see gas for what it was, a cover-up. We all know that serious gas ignitions push out walls. There have been far too many examples recently. The Ronan Point disaster was a classic example. But no walls were pushed out at Crystal Palace. Let's look at what we've got. At 7 o'clock, we probably had fire number 1 behind the organ. At 7:25, fire number 2 in the ladies' cloakroom. Some minutes later, fire number 3 in the Egyptian fort. More than one fire in differing locations is often the hallmark, the modus operandi, of the fire raiser or arsonist. Add to this a quantity of inflammable liquid lying on a floor, and in a place where such liquids are not normally used or stored, and I should think that the answer is obvious. In that case, we have but two questions to ask. What motivated the fire raisers, and who were they? Arsonists can be motivated by a host of factors. There can be many grey areas in their mental makeup, but usually they break down into these categories. A. The pyromaniac, being one who gains a twisted self-satisfaction from starting fires. B. One who sets a fire to cover up another crime, for example, murder or robbery. C. One who sets a fire in order to defraud an insurance company. D. Revenge, often against an employer. E. Political motivation. The classic example most quoted being the burning of the Reichstag Palace in Berlin, either by the Nazis or the communists. Controversy still rages over that one. The first mentioned, A and B, do not fit the bill. Let's look at C, D and E. During my research, I met many people who genuinely look upon Sir Henry Buckland as being a sinister, shadowy figure, a selfish opportunist who fired the palace in order to collect the insurance money and enrich himself. I believe this to be a gross and cruel libel of a man who, although having many faults, devoted most of his life to the Crystal Palace. The building itself was insured by a first loss policy for £110,000, placed with Lloyd's underwriters. The Handel organ was separately insured for £10,000, while other insurances on certain contents amounted to another £70,000. This was a grand total of £190,000. Mr. Henderson of Wells Park Road, Sydenham, clerk of works to Sir Henry, for many years told me that Sir Henry would not spend a penny of the insurance money. Not even accrued interest on maintenance essentials. A palace truck was running around without a license for some years, so obsessive had Sir Henry become about saving every penny. He saw in that insurance money his hope of some day rebuilding his beloved palace, although the sum was pathetically small when related to inflation. Even in 1936 values, £6 million was the estimate for rebuilding. It is on record that when the trustees handed over to the old LCC, the insurance money plus £30,000, which was the scrap metal value of the ruined palace, was handed over intact. Well, let us look now at motive D. A grudge against an employer, a possibility at the palace. Sir Henry Buckland was arrogant. He was vain. He was highly individualistic. Many found him difficult, even impossible to get on with. Some hated him. Mr. Henderson told me that hammers and other tools were dropped near him in the palace. Mr. Marsh, the plumber, bore witness to this, telling me that workmen on the roof and high galleries were known to let tools fall if Sir Henry was about. Irene Buckland put it this way. My father had no time for slackers. He would sack them on the spot. Now, according to Mr. Henderson and Mr. Marsh, Sir Henry's interpretation of the word slacker, Cuddin did include people whose face simply didn't fit. On the other hand, if one's face did fit, slacker or not, Sir Henry could be paternalistic, helping out with money if they became sick or were going through a tough spot. With this big stick and carrot brand of industrial relations, Sir Henry was wide open to a grudge-motivated attack. Obtaining evidence to support this theory is now well-nigh impossible, because the personnel records of the employees were destroyed in the fire, and too much time has elapsed. Let us look finally at political motivation. On the 9th of June 1920, the forerunner of what is now the Imperial War Museum was opened at Crystal Palace. During its four-year run, 5 million people paid to see this armourer's emporium. Among them were ex-German Zeppelin and other Gotha crews, who had bombed London during the war. They told Sir Henry Buckland that they had very strict orders not to bomb the Crystal Palace, because it was a perfect marker beacon for London. Now, this is well documented. Lady Buckland very kindly lent me a descriptive booklet about the palace written by Sir Henry, on sale during the 20s and 30s in the palace souvenir shop. In this booklet, Sir Henry relates what the Germans told him. Crystal Buckland flew over the palace in a light aircraft. She told me that when London was hidden by low cloud and fog made the Thames invisible, the Crystal Palace and its towers still stood out above the cloud and fog. On a clear, moonlit night, it was like a huge mirror laid out on the ground. Any airline captain, old enough to remember using Croydon, will tell you that they lined up on the Crystal Palace towers, just as at Heathrow they line up on the Staines gas holders today on a visual approach. On the 7th of March 1936, Hitler reoccupied the Rhineland, demilitarized under the terms of the Versailles Treaty. On May 1, 1936, Mussolini triumphed over Abyssinia, and in July 1936 the Spanish Civil War commenced. The dictators were on the rampage. I do not subscribe to the view that the government had the palace fired in order to deny the Germans a beacon. But I most certainly do subscribe to the view that the group outside the government probably did. The government, like most reasonable people at the time, believed that Germany had gotten a raw deal at Versailles, and that Chancellor Hitler had a case. There were those, however, who thought otherwise. There were those who saw Hitler as a maniac of ferocious genius, right from the start, and saw Britain to be in terrible danger. At 7 p.m. on November 30th, 1936, someone probably lit a fire under the staging and handle organ. This was the best place, the staging and organ well dried out, with the worst fire risks in the palace. Thwarted by a passerby, they lit a second fire in the ladies' cloakroom, which was still close to the staging and organ. Remember, the wind was from the north. The cloakroom was to the north of the centre transept, the staging and the organ. The ladies' cloakroom was well hidden from the parade, and passers-by, fearful that the second attempt... was being thwarted by the intervention of Mr. Clark and Mr. Tullett, they lit the third fire in the Egyptian court, with a trail of inflammable spirit leading straight to the staging and organ. The motive, either the working off of a personal grudge against Sir Henry Buckland, or the removal of Hermann Göring's signpost to London. My book is a proposition based on circumstantial rather than positive evidence. I put the same proposition to you. A maniac of ferocious genius right from the start, and saw Britain to be in terrible danger. At 7 p.m. on November 30th, 1936, someone probably, and I say probably, lit a fire under the staging and handle organ. This was the best place, the staging and organ well dried out, with the worst fire risks in the palace. Watered by a passerby, they lit a second fire in the ladies' cloakroom, which was still close to the staging and organ. Remember, the wind was from the north. The cloakroom was to the north of the centre transept, the staging and the organ. The ladies' cloakroom was well hidden from the parade, and passers-by, fearful. The cloakroom was well hidden from the parade and passers-by, fearful that the second attempt was being thwarted by the intervention of Mr. Clark and Mr. Tullett, they lit a third fire in the Egyptian court, with a trail of inflammable spirit leading straight to the staging and organ. The motive, either the working off of a personal grudge against Sir Henry Buckland, or the removal of Hermann Göring's signpost to London. My book is a proposition based on circumstantial rather than positive evidence. I put the same proposition to you tonight.
Now, one factor
Dad, more than any other... Dad, you turn the mic around a bit because you're a bit low.
This is the delay we were calling the fire brigade. Although we have been given much earlier times for the outbreak by several witnesses, 7:25 seems to be the most quoted and is probably about right. At 7:59 p.m., Penge Fire Brigade were called and responded at once, arriving at the palace at about 8:03. The delay between the time of outbreak and calling the fire brigade was therefore about 34 minutes. Now, it has been suggested that the local fire brigades may have dilly-dallied over requesting assistance from London. This suggestion is without foundation. A request for a district call to the palace was received at Lambeth just after 8:00. Indeed, the chief officer of the London Fire Brigade at the time, the late Major C.C.B. Morris, relates in his book Call Fire how he had just finished dinner at about 8:00 when the phone rang in his flat at the new Lambeth headquarters to inform him of the district call for the palace. Major Morris writes as follows. From the balcony at the back of my flat on the fourth floor of our new headquarters, I could see the palace quite clearly in daytime. And on stepping outside hurriedly to try to see if there was any sign of fire, I saw a dull red glow lighting up the whole of the centre transept. Definitely a late call. The fire must have been going for at least half an hour. We shall probably lose the whole building. This is, can be seen as a pretty accurate appraisal by Major Morris. About a minute later, and just as Major Morris was leaving headquarters in his staff car, he was informed that a brigade call had just come in. The delay between the arrival of the Penge Fire Brigade and the London Fire Brigade being called amounted to nothing. In fact, both events were more or less simultaneous. Why then did the palace delay so long? Two possible explanations are valid. A, that the palace staff became so preoccupied with trying to contain the fire that they simply forgot to call the fire brigade. A classic example of this is the recent Somerland disaster in the Isle of Man, of which the Commission of Inquiry had this to say, and I quote, "The great danger inherent in the firefighting party is that all concerned may so preoccupy themselves with fighting the fire, which is or becomes beyond their capacity to control, that no one remembers to call the fire brigade in time." There was a delay of 20 minutes at Somerland, and over 50 people died as a result of that delay. The second explanation being for the 34-minute delay at Crystal Palace, and what is to me the more valid of the two, is to be found in Section 30 of the Metropolitan Fire Brigades Act of 1865, still in force in 1936. Section 30 of the Act reads as follows. "It shall be lawful for the Board of Works, when occasion requires, to permit any part of the fire brigade establishment with their various equipment to proceed beyond the limits of the metropolis. In such cases, the owner and occupier of the property shall be jointly and separately liable to defray all the expenses that may be incurred by the fire brigade attending the fire. You are probably already aware that in 1936 the Crystal Palace lay just beyond the limits of the metropolis. You may also know of Sir Henry Buckland's anxiety about money and his reluctance to spend it. He knew that fire in the palace could cost him dear if the London Fire Brigade got in on the act. And in order to prevent this happening, he gave the palace firemen a strict standing order that they must under no circumstances call the outside fire brigade without first obtaining his permission, or, in his absence, the permission of Mr. Legg, who was his confidential private secretary. In other words, Sir Henry Buckland or Mr. Legg took it wholly upon themselves to decide when a fire was beyond their capacity to control and extinguish it. Of course, neither of them were qualified to make a decision of that nature. But it is excusable when it is realised that on the 29th of May 1937, Sir Henry Buckland received a bill from the London Fire Brigade for £2,569.13/7. This being the charge for their attendance on December 30th, 1936. Now, in terms of 1936 values, £2,569.13 was enormous. It was an enormous sum of money, and one to be avoided like the plague, if one was forced to count pennies like Sir Henry Buckland. I've often wondered since where the London Fire Brigade got the odd 13 shillings and 7 pence from. Now, on the morning after the fire, Sir Henry Buckland made a statement to the press and the Fire, which is the highly respected journal of the British Fire Service, a journal respected throughout the world for the accuracy of its reporting. This is what Sir Henry Buckland said, and I quote, "A streak of flame ran along the top of the room, and the place was ablaze in a moment. We thought then the gas was the cause. Now we know." He enlarged on this by claiming that there was a large gas container or tank near to where the fire started, containing many thousands of cubic feet of gas under pressure. Now, in 1971, when I started researching my book, Mr. W.E. Medhurst was principal distributing engineer for the South Eastern Gas Board. In 1936, he was a young engineer with the old South Suburban Gas Company, and he worked out of Sydenham Gas Works, distribution being his specialty, and the Crystal Palace one of his biggest consumers. For this reason, he had to familiarise himself with the palace gas supply. Mr. Medhurst told me in a letter that the supply for the palace was a normal low-pressure main, working at less than half a pound per square inch. The main was situated in the basement, entirely below ground floor level. Small bore pipes brought gas upwards to where it was required to be used in the building. Some gas lights out on the terrace required a slightly higher pressure of 2 pounds per square inch, which was achieved by means of a small compressor located outside the palace in a brick building on the parade. The compressor was not in use on the night of the fire because the terrace lights were not lit. I questioned Mr. Medhurst carefully about Sir Henry Buckland's large gas container or tank. This was Mr. Medhurst's answer, and I quote, "I am completely at a loss to understand what Sir Henry Buckland was talking about when he spoke of a large tank or container containing many thousands of cubic feet of gas under pressure. We most certainly never had any storage tank of any kind at the Crystal Palace. Even the gas meter was in a completely separate building." Mr. H. M. Marsh, maintenance plumber for many years at the Crystal Palace, can remember no gas containers such as Sir Henry Buckland described anywhere within the complex. Like Mr. Medhurst, Mr. Marsh insists that the gas meter was in a completely separate building. Leaving the argument about gas to one side for a moment, let us look at the sequence of events on night in question. Mr. S. Neal looked after the boilers which heated the greenhouses in the palace gardens. He told me in a letter that he worked late that night until 7 o'clock, at which time he had left his greenhouses and arrived at the time clock near the main entrance in the centre transept. He had just punched his time card dead on 7 o'clock when a passerby came in to tell a palace fireman that there was a red glow inside the glass. The fireman, Mr. Neal, went to the spot indicated by the passerby, where he found a small fire burning at the back of the handle organ, close to the underside of the orchestra stadium. Now, according to Mr. Neal, this fire was extinguished without difficulty. Now, I must point out to that I want to emphasize this. I have not to date found anyone to confirm Mr. Neal's account. If there is anyone here able to throw light on this, then I ask them to come forward later. The late Mr. Sidney Clark, known as Horace to his close friends, was dead before I commenced my research. But his widow was able to tell me of her husband's experiences on the night of the fire. Their account is almost identical with one to be found in the record room at County Hall, and it's probably the most authentic we can hope for after a lapse of so many years. Mr. Clark was a night shift palace fireman. His whole life was spent working at the palace, except for war service in France, 1914-1918. He was conscientious and took his duty seriously. He was well liked. He was on his first security patrol of the night and arrived in the Egyptian court at about 7:20. He could smell burning, but could find nothing amiss in the court itself. So he widened his search going into the passageway, which ran between the Egyptian court and the administrative offices which overlooked Crystal Palace Parade. In this passageway was a ladies' cloakroom, and inside it, Mr. Clark found a fire burning, which in his opinion, although in its early stages, and certainly not serious, would require a hose to extinguish it. To get a hose to work, Mr. Clark needed help. So he shouted for Mr. Frank Tullett, or obviously better known. Mr. Tullett was not a fireman. He was a general handyman who had offered to see the night through with Mr. Clark because his regular mate had reported sick. This information was given me by Frank Tullett's daughter, who now lives near me in Hertfordshire. The first aid hose reels were not like the present day type, which can be operated by one person. The water coming on automatically as the hoses ran out. In 1936, the hose was canvas and flaked. That is, it was hung on pegs and looped rather than rolled. A separate hand wheel control valve had to be opened to bring on the water. Mr. Clark held the branch pipe and nozzle, while Mr. Tullett operated the hand wheel, which he spun to the fully open position too quickly. The sudden rush of water caused the hose to kick backwards violently, throwing Mr. Clark off his feet and breaking his dentures and his glasses. This kicking effect with charged hose is very familiar to firemen who are trained to deal with it safely. Leaving Mr. Clark to recover as best he could, Mr. Tullett ran to get help, going first to Mr. Legg's house. Mr. Legg responded at once, and while heading for the palace, sent Mr. Tullett to Rock Hills. To alert Sir Henry Buckman, who happened to be coming out of it at this time, along with his daughter Crystal. In an interview, Crystal Buckman told me that she could remember Bobby Tullett running up the road to meet them, as they turned out of Rock Hills. She wondered why he was running about outside, and not knowing about Mr. Legg's instruction, considered that he should have been inside fighting the fire. Mr. Legg reached the fire first, and with Mr. Clark's help got the hose to work in a minute. He got the hose back to work. In a minute or two, Sir Henry and his daughter, and Nobby Tullett, had arrived. At this point, the fire was still confined to the ladies' cloakroom and relatively small. Sir Henry sent his daughter to the garden hall to inform the rehearsing orchestra of the fire and to reassure them that the fire was under control and that it was safe for them to continue rehearsing. Crystal Bottom, or Mrs. King as she now is, confirmed this when I talked to her. While Crystal was away to the garden hall, the fire situation worsened with catastrophic suddenness. As already noted, Sir Henry described it as a streak of flame running along the room. But Mr. Legg was much more specific. In a statement made to staff reporter Alan Rams of the Daily Mail, Mr. Legg had this to say. Shortly after my arrival, I was told that fire had now broken out in the Egyptian hall. On looking in there, I found that part of the hall was ablaze, and a stream of flame was racing across the floor like a will-o'-the-wisp. We turned three hoses on it, but in what seemed no time, the trail of flame had blazed into the center transept. Within 15 minutes, the whole interior was a mass of flames. Now, Collins' New English Dictionary defines a will-o'-the-wisp as, sometimes referred to as jack-o'-lantern, a flickering, pale, bluish flame darting rapidly from location to location and seen over marshes. This was Mr. Legg's stream of flame racing across the floor. If it resembled a will-o'-the-wisp, then it was blue in colour. If it was blue in colour, then it is almost certain that it was some kind of inflammable spirit. But which? Now, to answer this, I put the problem to Her Majesty's Fire Research Station at Boreham Wood. Now, for those of you not in the know, this fire research establishment is recognised as being the world's best and is staffed by engineers and scientists eminent in their field. Mr. P.M.T. Smart, the director of the station, wrote to me as follows. The eyewitness account of the bluish flames or will-o'-the-wisp racing along the floor is very interesting. The theory about gas being the cause can probably be discounted because town gas is much lighter than air and it is therefore unlikely that a thin layer of gas would stay at floor level. A serious gas leak would more likely have resulted in an explosion if exposed to a source of ignition. The transient coloured flames on the floor surface would seem to indicate the presence of an inflammable liquid having a flash point below room temperature. Whiskey, as suggested by you as a possible accidental spillage, has too high a flash point, and petrol does not fit the colour description. But methylated spirit, acetone, and cellulose nitrate are the ones to go for, and they're all possibilities worth considering. Sir Henry Buckland's tale about gas now is decidedly threadbare. A serious gas leak in the presence of an igniter would likely result in an explosion. Now, Paul L. Kirk is a leading authority on the subject of fire investigation. In his book, he tells us that to turn gas to ignite, a ratio of at least 1 in 10 must be achieved. That is 1 volume of gas to 10 volumes of air. This will produce a rolling fire, which is termed a diffuse explosion. This will push out walls, singe human hair, and set clothing alight. There will be no hard detonation, rather a whoosh, and the whole place will be on fire. If Sir Henry Buckland's streak of flame was gas, then everybody in the vicinity would have had their clothing ignited and they would have suffered burns. We know that neither occurred at Crystal Palace. I think that we can now see gas for what it was, a cover-up. We all know that serious gas ignitions push out walls. There have been far too many examples recently of this. The Roman Point disaster was a classic example. But no walls were pushed out of Crystal Palace, at least not in the early stages of the fire. Let's look at what we've got. At 7 o'clock, we probably had fire number one. I say probably, because I've had no confirmation except for Mr. Neal's account. We probably had fire number one behind Yorick. At 7:25, fire number two in the ladies' cloakroom. Some minutes later, fire number three in the Egyptian court. More than one fire in differing locations is often the hallmark, the modus operandi of the fire raiser or arsonist. Add to this a quantity of inflammable liquid lying on a floor, and in a place where such liquids are not normally used or stored, and I should think that the answer is obvious. In that case, we have but two questions to ask. What motivated the fire raisers? And who were they? Now, arsonists can be motivated by a host of factors. There can be many grey areas in their mental makeup, but usually they break down into these categories. A, we have the pyromaniac, being one who gains a twisted self-satisfaction from starting fires. B, one who sets fire to cover up another crime, for example, murder or robbery. C, one who sets a fire in order to defraud an insurance company. D, revenge, and this is often against an employer. E, political motivation. The classic example, most quoted, of course, being the burning of the Reichstag Palace in Berlin, either by the Nazis or the communists. Controversy still rages over that one. The first mentioned, A and B, do not fit the bill. Let's look at C, D, and E. During my research, I met many people who genuinely look upon Sir Henry Butler as being a sinister, shadowy figure, a selfish opportunist, who fired the palace in order to collect the insurance and enrich himself. I believe this to be a gross and cruel libel of a man who, although having many faults, devoted most of his life to the Crystal Palace. Now, the building itself was insured by a first loss policy for £110,000, placed with Lloyd's underwriters. The hand war room was separately insured for £10,000. While other insurances on certain contents amounted to another £70,000, a grand total of £190,000. Now, Mr. Henderson at Wells Park Road, Sydney, was clerk of the works to Sir Henry Buckland for many years. He told me that Sir Henry would not spend a penny of the insurance money, not even the accrued interest, on maintenance essentials. A palace truck was running around without a license for some years, so obsessed as Sir Henry become about saving every penny. He saw in that insurance money his hope of someday rebuilding his beloved palace, although the sum was pathetically small when related to inflation. Even in 1936 values, £6 million was the estimate for rebuilding the palace. It is on record that when the trustees handed over to the old LCC the insurance money plus £30,000, which was the scrap metal value of the ruined palace, was handed over intact. Let's look now at motive D, a grudge against an employer, a possibility at the palace. Sir Henry Buckland was arrogant. He was vain. He was highly individualistic. Many found it difficult, even impossible, to get on with. Some detested him. Mr. Henderson told me that hammers and other tools were dropped near him in the palace. Mr. Marsh, the plumber, bore witness to this, telling me that workmen on the roof and high galleries were known to let tools fall if Sir Henry Buckland was about. Irene Buckland put it this way: my father had no time for slackers. He would sack them on the spot. Now, according to Mr. Henderson and Mr. Marsh, Sir Henry's interpretation of the word slacker could and did include people whose face simply did not fit. On the other hand, if one's face did fit, slacker or not, Sir Henry could be paternalistic. helping them out with money if they became sick, or if they were going through a tough spot. With this big stick and carrot brand of industrial relations, Sir Henry was wide open to a grudge-motivated attack. Obtaining evidence to support this theory is now well-nigh impossible, because the personnel records of the employees were destroyed in the fire, and too much time has elapsed. Let us look finally at political motivation. On the 9th of June 1920, the forerunner of what is now the Imperial War Museum was opened at Crystal Palace. During its four-year run, 5 million people paid to see this armourer's emporium. Among them were ex-German Zeppelin and Gotha crews who had bombed London during the war. They told Sir Henry Buckland that they had very strict orders not to bomb the Crystal Palace, because it was a perfect marker beacon for London. Now, this is well documented. Lady Buckland very kindly lent me a descriptive booklet about the palace, written by Sir Henry. And this was on sale during the 1920s and the 1930s in the palace souvenir shop. In this booklet, Sir Henry relates what the Germans told him. Crystal Buckland flew over the palace in a light aircraft. She told me that when London was hidden by low cloud and fog, made the Thames invisible, the Crystal Palace and its towers still stood out above the cloud and fog. On a clear moonlit night, it was like a huge mirror laid out on the ground. Any airline captain, old enough to remember using Croydon, will tell you that they lined up on the Crystal Palace towers, just as at Heathrow, they line up on the Staines gas holders today when on a visual approach. On the 7th of March 1936, Hitler reoccupied the Rhineland, demilitarized under the terms of the Versailles Treaty. On May 1st, 1936, Mussolini triumphed over Abyssinia. And in July 1936, the Spanish Civil War commenced, so the dictators were on the rampage. Now, I do not subscribe to the view that the government had the palace fired in order to deny the Germans a beacon. But I most certainly do subscribe to the view that a group outside of government probably did. The government, like most reasonable people at the time, believed the Germans had got the war given to the side, and that Chancellor Hitler had a case. There were those, however, who thought otherwise. There were those who saw Hitler as a maniac and ferocious genius right from the start, and saw Britain to be in terrible danger. At 7 p.m. on November 30th, 1936, somebody probably, and I say probably, lit a fire over the stadium and the hand organ. This was the best place. The stadium and the organ were well dried out. They were the worst fire risks in the palace. Watered by a passerby, the arsonist then probably lit a second fire in the ladies' cloakroom, which was still close to the staging and organ. Remember, as already has been described tonight, remember that the wind was from the north. The cloakroom was to the north of the centre transept. The staging and organ. Yes, the wind, that's right. The cloakroom was to the north of the centre transept and the staging and the organ. The ladies' cloakroom was well hidden from the parade and passers-by. Fearful that the second attempt was being thwarted by the intervention of Mr. Clark and Mr. Tollett, it's probable that they lit the third fire in the Egyptian court. But the trail of inflammable spirit leading straight to the staging and organ. The motive, either the working off of a personal grudge against Sir Henry Buckland, or the removal of Hermann Göring's signpost to London. My book is a proposition based on circumstantial evidence rather than on positive evidence. I put the same proposition to you tonight and throw the thing open to discussion. Now, before closing, I have just one further point to make. In his book, called Phoenix summer. Alan White, possibly caught in the fire as being an accumulation of dust and rubbish in the basement, ignited by a carelessly discarded cigarette. Now, little is known about dust fires in 1936, but recent research has shown that fire can propagate in certain types of dust distributed in layers and heaps. Dusts in this category are timber sawdust, rubber dust, textile dust or fluff, and solid fuel dusts, coal, coke, and anthracite, all of which could be present in the Crystal Palace basement. If a thick layer of dust is deposited on a hot surface, for example, boilers, flues, central heating pipes, and the minimum thickness is 2 millimetres, a deep-seated, very slow smouldering fire can propagate within the base of the layer or heap. This deep-seated smouldering will remain undetected because it produces neither smoke nor smell. As is usually associated with burning. The smell, if any, will be exceedingly slight and of a musty nature, as in the damp room. Now this small smoldering can continue over many weeks and even months until it finally reaches the surface of the layer. Even at this stage, detection is difficult, because the only visible sign will be a slight surface discoloration, as ash is formed. Only with the sudden introduction of high oxygen content air will visible glowing and flaming commence, sufficient to ignite adjacent combustibles. Over many years, millions of people walked through this path. Rubber dust off shoes, textile dust off fluff, clothing, and solid fuel dust from the boilers, and all existed in the palace basement. And remember that the central heating boilers were in the basement. What Alan Warwick fails to take account of is that the boilers were not lit on the night of the fire. So there was no heat source. And his cigarette theory does not relate to the many other factors which I have brought forward tonight, such as the willow trees. In fairness to Warwick, the fire is not his subject, and is mentioned in his book only as a small part of the palace's office. Thank you very much.